Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about a television show that we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the first season of Stargirl. Now, this lasted 13 episodes, and for me, it was kind of odd to watch this.
Well, let's slow down. It was made for DC Universe, the streaming service, right?
It was originally done for that, but then it was going to air almost concurrently or whatever on the CW. I forget exactly where it aired first or whatnot. I think it's moving to the CW.
I was going to say, I thought it came out on DC Universe soon after DC Universe launched their streaming. And then it was announced, it did so well, that CW was picking it up for at least that first season.
I thought it was airing on DC Universe, but then going to do like a next day on CW or something like that. I honestly couldn't keep track.
Interesting.
There's some stuff there, and I think it's moving to CW now that DC Universe is winding down.
I hadn't realized.
Or DC maybe it's going to HBO Max. Like I said, I can't keep this stuff straight. For me, what was weird watching this is I grew up reading a lot of these characters, not Stargirl herself, but this is really pulling from the Stars and Stripes series that Geoff Johns did, I think, starting in 1999. And it went about a year or so. It didn't last all that long. Maybe 15 issues, give or take. Zero issue in there, too. But the other series it was pulling from was Infinity Inc.
Mm-hmm.
That was a spin-off title from All-Star Squadron, which is one of the titles I got in early. And that launched, I think, in 1980. And All-Star Squadron was tales of the other Earth 2 characters other than the JSA back in World War II. That did well enough that they did a then-modern-day series set in the 80s of their, like, really, at that point, it was their kids. You know, as time goes on, it almost would need to be their grandkids or whatever. But many of the characters we got here were either from Stars and Stripe, such as Stargirl, Stripe, Shiv, Cindy.
Stripe as in with the red and white shirt or the robot?
The robot version.
Okay.
Although he was still Stripesy.
Okay.
And that character goes all the way back to like the 40s and stuff because he was the adult sidekick of the teen Star Spangled Kid. I'll get more into their backstory and stuff. But some of the other characters, this version of Our Man, Wildcat, and Dr. Midnight were from the Infinity Inc. run.
Mm.
And that series, about a year and a half into its 50-some-odd issue run, was when Crisis on Infinite Earths hit. Which is a little funny, because this takes place after Crisis on Infinite Earths for the CW universe. The difference is, the CW's Crisis basically created this new Earth 2 for them to inhabit. Crisis on Infinite Earths for the DC universe took what was a fairly vibrant and active Earth 2 universe in DC, and basically said, nope, we're just going to have a single universe, and just pulled the rug out from All-Star Squadron, Infinity Inc., and a few other things. They had to figure out, well, what do we do if there wasn't a Superman and Wonder Woman and Batman back in the Golden Age and stuff like that? So a lot of the core members of Infinity Inc. kind of almost couldn't be used here because they were two of them. One was the son of Hawkman and Hawkwoman. One was the godson of. One was the daughter of Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had Huntress, who's daughter of Catwoman and Batwoman, Batman on Earth 2. Power Girl, the Earth 2 Supergirl. And I'm trying to think who were some of the original members of Infinity Inc. One of the early ones was Brainwave Jr. Now, we get Brainwave, we get some of these other characters here, but it was a mishmash of those two titles, and it was a very young version of them.
Well, my problem with the teen set throughout was it felt like Okay, first of all, they were trying to do the supervillains are the hero of their own story, which I get, and it mostly worked.
Their version of the Injustice Society, yeah, they very much played, even though they were robbing banks, they thought they were heroes.
Yeah, well, and I mean, especially what they're doing in Blue Valley.
Doing in Blue Valley is totally, they think they're the heroes of their story.
Yeah. But I guess what I kept stumbling on was they all had spouses and kids who were 6 or 7 when they turned this corner towards being the hero of their own story versus I think I would have preferred if they had set that battle with the JSA that kind of kicked off this series as being right before they settled down into relationships and had kids. So it was kind of a, we wiped out the obstacle that was preventing us from being able to feel secure, feel safe, and feel like we could have families and kids.
If this series had been titled JSA instead of Stargirl, I think they should have had an episode that was set after that aftermath battle and stuff that explained why the Injustice Society went from robbing banks and all this stuff to kind of sort of in their own minds being the hero of their own story, but without being do-gooders.
Well, they made it seem like this was all Jordan's idea because of how his wife died.
But how did he get Sportsmaster and Tigress and the others to buy in on it? How did he even get them to effectively retire? There's some unanswered questions there.
Because it was all... He still phrases it as an evil plot of mind control.
Well, and it is.
Yes.
I loved when they got to the point of, okay, this big undertaking is going to happen, and the new Dr. Midnight is reading this manifesto.
Yes.
Solar power, you know, defeat global warming and all of, you know, universal healthcare, all of these other things. And the kids are all like, are we sure we're on the right side of this?
Yeah.
And then it gets to the, oh yeah, and 25% of the people are going to keel over and die in the process.
Yeah.
Oh, that we can get behind.
Being bad.
Well, yes, they can get behind fighting that. Sorry, yeah. But even when Icicle, who I think did a great job throughout,
yeah,
and that was the same actor we'd seen over on Absentia, but when he's sitting there basically saying that, you know, so many people die of cancer, and if that one-time cost would wipe out cancer, wouldn't you pay it? And how he was justifying some of the stuff.
Yeah.
But I never got why Brainwave was willing, I guess kind of why he killed his wife, a little bit for killing the son, but it, I don't know, it just, there was a little more they could have solidified on some
his
of
his wife was trying to weaken him, is how it was described.
He killed her brother. He knew she'd never forgive him.
Yes.
So if he's essentially going to be dead to her.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think the character that they actually did the best with, which shocked me when I realized it, was Brainwave Jr.
It was funny because early on in the episodes, this, first off, this has a huge cast.
Yes.
And Brainwave Jr., there's Cameron, who's essentially going to be Icicle Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also Rick, who's Hourman. And Rick and Cameron look enough alike.
Yes.
And then you've got two sons of of Injustice Society members. So it was a little hard at first to kind of keep track. Now, which character is this again? And there was one or two, like Joey, the son of the wizard. I was like, who was this in the comics? Now, again, this is riffing off comics from Stars and Stripes 20 years ago, Infinity Inc. 40 years ago, that it's like, yeah, I can't remember all of this. And it turns out, well, he wasn't riffing on anyone because they killed him in short order. But I think the legacy aspect was genetic and familial on the villain side, but all almost by proxy or inheritance or happenstance on the hero side, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, on the hero side, it was intelligence, ingenuity. I mean, yes, we did have one that was pseudo-genetic in terms of he could use his father's hourglass.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
But his father had created the hourglass, had figured out the science, used the science, etc. So it was really for me, the heroes can use their minds and their brains and create the tools they need, the devices they need, learn the skills.
Yep. For me, having read Infinity Inc., which again had a lot of resonance with this, or this had resonance with that, I should say, where it was literally the sons and daughters of the JSA.
Mm.
And here, it's whoever happened to be handed, you know, Wildcat's costume that magically had the powers.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a couple of things where they changed up the powers and abilities of the characters to make it more suitable for modern television. You know, when we got these versions of Hourman, Dr. Midnight, and Wildcat in the comics, it was one of the many times where there was an attempt to kind of diversify the characters. You've got three characters that are white males. Well, let's take one of them. Okay, he'll be the son, white male. Got it. Okay. Let's make one, you know, Latina. Let's make another, you know, another ethnicity and stuff like that. And I'm all for representation. And they were at least making new versions of the characters.
Well, and Dr. Midnight grew on me and worked for me by the end. I was worried in the beginning.
It did. And what I found fascinating with the character was the approach they took, the bond with the goggles, mm-hmm. which he had goggles, but originally they weren't the high-tech type. And this version of the character in the comics had a very different costume.
Mm.
Here, they stuck with the old-school costume, which made sense given the approach they're taking on the show. But
well, on the show, they had very high-tech goggles with a combination of AI, but the inventor had kind of programmed himself into the AI, if you will.
It's what if Tony Stark had built an AI based on his own, you know, mentality.
Yeah.
And you just had kind of the glasses that we saw in one of the Spider-Man movies.
Yeah. Only it's, you know, the equivalent of Tony Stark. Here it's
Charles McKnider.
Yeah, talking to you all the time. And I just love the way that the character Beth is like, he's my best buddy, Chuck. And by the end, Chuck's saying, you know, she's my best buddy.
But it was interesting. They played Dr. Midnight as if he were Iron Man or Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, the comic character. And I'm not saying it's a crazy stretch or whatever, but for somebody who is an actual medical doctor in the comics, both versions of him, actually. And actually, there was another version even after that in the comics, all of which were doctors. And at least two of them, I forget if the female version had it too, had vision problems where they could only see at night.
Mm, interesting.
Hence Dr. Midnight. Yeah. Hence the goggles to block the thing out to where they could see in the low light, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the other character that they changed the power basis for, but not really the powers themselves, is Hourman.
Mm.
It wasn't the hourglass. Now, there is a version that has an hourglass component, but the original one, and I totally get and support why they changed this, he would pop a pill.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd get an hour of power.
Yeah.
And it was a miracle or something like that, which is similar to kind of the stuff they used in Arrow.
I was going to say Mirakuru
is the same kind of basis. It was inspired by, I should say. Wildcat's powers were innate, which is basically he was a boxer.
Well, and they had picked a girl who had definitely been training up on self-defense, gave her an interesting backstory, and then the claws that kind of shot out.
Well, the high-tech suit that form-fitted to her.
Yeah.
Allowed her to always land on her feet, gave her the claws and a few things like that, like the balance and stuff. It amped up her physicality.
Yeah.
Whereas in the comics, the original one didn't need that. And this version of her in the comics, I'm trying to think if she actually had some powers along the lines of what the suit gave this version.
Well, it's funny because I felt for both Wildcat and Dr. Midnight, the suits in a way compensated for the being teenagers, if you know what I mean.
you can't be a highly trained athlete at
15.
Because it's hard to tell exactly how old they are, but 15 sounds about right.
Well, Beth said she'd be 16 soon.
Right. But that's the other thing that I think puts this show in a very interesting position. Most of these other DC Universe shows, and I mean that DC Universe, not the streaming system, but I mean Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, etc., easily go 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Yeah.
When you're starting with characters around 15.
Mm.
And then you go 6, 7, 8 years. They're out of high school. They're in college. And to me, the way this show ends is she's no longer Stargirl. She's Star Woman.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to me, it was very interesting. They dealt with the stepfamily dynamic.
Yes. And I thought they built that well over the course of the season.
Yeah. And they did a lot of interesting and good stuff. I think the character that got the short end of the stick in the family dynamic was Mike.
He was used sparingly. There was a couple of times I had expected him to play in a little bit more. We never see him outside of the family dynamic.
Yeah. Well, and he's the one who says, I've made friends at school. We never see signs of friends.
Hear a name. Yes. And the name Jakeem, I want to point out, because in the JSA comic, Jakeem was the one who got the Thunderbolt.
Mm.
Now, the Thunderbolt is currently sitting in a pink ballpoint pen in Courtney's room.
Yeah.
Which would be, you know, what I was expecting at some point was an episode where Jakeem has come over, he and Mike are doing something, needs a pen, oh, just go grab one out of my sister's room. Boom, in comes the Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things they set up and didn't pay off.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that we never see Mike outside of interacting with the family.
Yeah. I mean, even when we're at the school science fair.
It's all about his relationship with Barbara.
Yeah.
You know, he is in service of that plot.
Yeah.
And I really don't remember enough of the character from the Stars and Stripes series to remember if he really went anywhere.
Well, and yet he does kind of fit with what I was saying earlier of his age makes sense to the timeline they gave mm-hmm. us. In terms of Pat Dugan was all about the JSA, the fight with the bad guys. They thought the fight was over. They thought it was settled. Whether or not he won, then he seems to have started a family.
What we never got out of this season that I recall, and maybe I've just forgotten already, Mike's mom.
No, we never found out what Pat Dugan did between that battle and Sylvester giving him the staff and trusting him to the staff, but, you know, not you to use it.
Yeah, yeah,
but
that was
take the staff, little... but not you.
The first time of somebody will take over, and she's like, I'll do it. No, not you.
Yeah.
Okay, the third time or fourth time, it's like, dude, I get it.
Yeah, that was a humor fail.
Yeah.
But I'm certain whoever put that in there thought they were going to get humor out of it.
Oh, absolutely.
And it just, yeah, didn't work.
Well, and just to compare to the comics one more time, in the comics, the one who had the staff was Jack Knight, who was one of the sons of Ted Knight, the original Starman.
Mm.
Now, the original Starman had a cosmic rod that was, you know, like a foot or two. I mean, it was almost like the size of one of these microphones we're holding, not this, you know, 5, 6 foot, you know, staff or whatever. But by the time it got to Jack Knight, again, this is going back to like the 90s, so I'm forgetting some of this stuff in my old age. He had the staff as we've seen it here, and I think they did an awesome job recreating it here.
The staff here had unique shape, it glowed, but it had personality for the first two-thirds, really.
Oh, it was like the family pet.
Yeah.
Which I don't recall it being that way in the Starman comic. Again, I haven't read the Stars and Stripes series since it was published 20 years ago, and I need to reread that.
Well, it's almost like R2-D2. Where you wish you spoke the beeps.
Yeah. I think they need to teach it how to write.
Ooh, that'd be hilarious.
Because then it could just do the script up in the air or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... She got his staff, not through Sylvester, who was Skyman, who was... He had the cosmic rod, but not the Cosmic Staff, I think it was. And he had turned, had the rod reworked into like a part of his costume and stuff. But the costume they had for him looked very much like his Skyman version.
Nice.
And this basically, what I loved about this show was it took a lot of the characters from Earth 2 that have never had, well, I was going to say never had TV versions, but that's not entirely true. We've gotten a version of the JSA in Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
We also got some of these characters in Smallville.
Mm.
That was the two-parter that the guy who played Daniel Jackson in Stargate.
Michael Shanks.
He played Hawkman, I believe it was. Need to rewatch those episodes. It'd be fun. And just seeing all these characters kind of come to life and stuff, and how they did such a great job both with the JSA in the opening scene, with the Injustice Society, and then these newer versions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Stargirl herself, I think they cast a good actress.
Yeah.
She did great with it. They got the costume perfect for the most part. A couple of times the mask seemed a little off or whatever. But the staff itself, they did an amazing job with. And the fight choreography.
Yeah.
The way, you know, they set up, okay, she's done gymnastics, and you can see that in the way the character moves, the way she and the staff fight.
Oh, there was some fun stuff with the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And the fight where her mom was in the room for it, and like the staff went over and caught her mom before she fell to the floor and stuff. There was a lot of fun stuff.
But there's backstory that needs to be told at some point of what's really the deal with the staff. What is its origin?
Yeah.
How can it do these things? Is it an AI? Is it something else?
Yeah.
And I don't think they need to have answered that this season. They needed to establish, and they did, how it acts. But at some point, somebody has to ask the question.
Yeah.
And that could be a good chance to get a flashback to early era JSA in that backstory. Because... And I need to rewatch the episodes when we first get the goggles for Dr. Midnight, because it was hard to tell, because it seemed like some of the dates they were giving for when some of the characters were born was like in the 1914, so they would have been around World War II, but then how were they around more present day?
Yeah, like Dr. Ito.
Yeah. Him, it's like, okay, maybe he's long lived. But the JSA themselves, I'm unclear at what point in time they were active other than a decade ago or ending a decade ago.
Yeah.
So there's some fuzziness in the timeline there,
but
not in a way that bothered me. Because I think part of the challenge with something like the JSA is they've always been anchored in World War II for their origin. Not that I think they have to be, but that was just kind of when they were originally created and it just kind of stuck. And it worked to have the sons and daughters in the 80s, but it's kind of hard to do that, you know, another 40 years down the line or something.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with how this had an arc for the season. Again, a few things like, why did they take on this initiative for the Injustice Society? I'd like explained a little better, but oh well, they didn't, so be it. I'm curious where they're planning on going next season. And up until that end shot at the water tower, it was pretty open-ended. Then we cut to Cindy, Ito's daughter, Shiv, from the Stars and Stripes comic, a villainess, digging around in the wizard's belongings. At first, I'm thinking, oh, she's going for the wand. She's not. She pulls out this black diamond and refers to Eclipso, which is a kind of a supernatural villain who has the ability to, you know, like, inhabit people. Now, how they're going to use it here, I don't know. It seemed kind of bizarre that she would willingly go searching around for something to essentially possess her. So maybe they're going in another direction. And then they had a thing at the tail end, introducing a, or reintroducing a character that almost has to show back up next season. But it's how?
Yeah.
Because it kind of undercut what we had thought was the case the entire time. And I'm curious if there's one or two other characters like Courtney's dad that we may see again.
That's 50-50. The way they wrote away.
It, we shouldn't. The way they cast it?
Yeah, exactly.
That was the guy who was the lead on The Finder. He's done some other stuff. To me, that's not the kind of actor you hire for an in-and-out kind of role.
Yeah.
Even as pivotal as that was.
Mm-hmm. Well, earth-shattering.
Certainly for Courtney.
Yeah. Well, and to a degree for her friends. But it was also pivotal in terms of it gave her friends a chance because she has been the positivity beacon.
Yes.
In that circle of friends up to that point, and it gave them a chance to turn around and be supportive of her.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think how many of the Injustice Society survive to be an issue next season.
I don't know enough about Jordan / Icicle to know if that actually killed him. I assumed it did, but I don't understand.
It seemed like it did, but they could bring him back if they really wanted to and just, oh, well, here's how he came back.
Yeah.
They could write it out.
The wizard is gone.
Wizard's gone.
Brainwave's gone.
Brainwave's gone. Fiddler's gone.
Yeah.
Solomon Grundy is out, but will come back, I think.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, at one point, he was kind of sort of a member of Infinity Inc.
I was going to say, they gave him a, hey, wait, these people don't abuse me.
Yeah.
I mean, they're mad at me because I murdered some of their family members, but that's justifiable anger. But when I let them have a temper tantrum, they don't abuse it.
In the comic, Infinity Inc., he was a villain for the Earth 2 Green Lantern. And two of the other, and that's who I'd forgotten earlier, original members of Infinity Inc. were Jade, who was the daughter of the Green Lantern and Harlequin, and she had kind of innate Green Lantern powers, and Obsidian, who had like shadow powers.
Now, we have some costumes we didn't distribute. We went to the JSA and we brought back, Courtney did a whole bunch of stuff, and she brought back a lantern.
And that would have been the Earth 2 Green Lantern's lantern.
Yeah, and a few other things. Because that's when she brought back the pen, the lantern.
But she didn't bring the ring back. So the Green Lantern power battery and the pen. We also know we've got the Jay Garrick Flash in this world.
Yes.
And the Hawks.
So she could empower more friends next season, conceivably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, as the season was playing out, we got a episode where it's basically, let's understand Brainwave.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to the point where Brainwave sits down in front of a camera.
He's recording the experiment he did on VHS.
Well, yes, of course.
Which, okay, we're setting it back 20-some years. That's fine. What got me was he would do one tape per day. He never seemed to talk for all that long.
Yeah.
And then another one, you know, another tape the next day. VHS tapes are roughly bulky. The size of a paperback book.
Yes.
If you're doing one per day and you've got day 3258 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
The little hidden closet he put all this stuff did not have enough room for those videotapes. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact the videotape recorder was still working and could be plugged into a TV.
Yes, yes.
And this goes back to it's modern day in this show. They've got smartphones, they've got flat screens and stuff like that.
It's a very magic universe.
Yeah.
But when they show us the first day that he goes from having lots of migraines and headaches to
knowing he can read people's minds.
Yeah, yeah, and kind of being able to use to any degree these powers. And it's somebody comes and mugs him. And I turn to you and I'm like, so if instead of his first encounter as actively powered, being with a mugger, if it had been with a beautiful woman he had no idea had a crush on him.
If it had been a positive experience, he could have been a superhero.
Yeah.
It's interesting because in the comic, Brainwave's definitely evil and such. They had at one point established he also had kind of the equivalent of illusion powers, which we'd seen later here. And was not as good looking as or muscular as he seemed to appear to people. Brainwave Jr., again, one of the early members of Infinity Inc. So when they killed him off here, it's like, wow, didn't see that coming.
Well, and I was fascinated by the way Courtney dealt with him, because it's, yeah, people think all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But we don't act our every thought, and some of our thoughts are basically just venting. And maybe you need to look beyond that surface thought that's just blowing off steam to what's under it.
Well, and that conversation kind of set up when Yolanda, Wildcat, you know, goes after him and stuff. Mm-hmm. It kind of proves Courtney's point.
Yeah.
That this isn't a bad person. They're just in a bad place.
Yes. Yes. Well, and Courtney says basically people act out of hurt, but most people want to be loved, mm-hmm. and are in truth acting in some sense out of love or that desire to be loved.
Yeah. Or fear of not being loved.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it was really good. And it was kind of a, going back to what I had said about Brainwave, if that first encounter
yeah.
had been positive instead of negative. And it was just really interesting that they chose to show that. And not just tell us, literally show us that.
If you think about it, the first experience Junior really had was with Courtney. And she's like, he's afraid, you know, and, yes. and got a better experience than his dad did.
Well, technically, his very first experience was with Yolanda calling him a jerk. He came stumbling yeah. out of the house and yeah. Yolanda said, jerk, in her mind.
Yeah. Well, and when Junior dies and dad kind of inherits the powers, the same thing happened, although in the other direction. In the comic, where dad died and the powers flow into Junior and kind of overload him for a little bit. And there have been times Junior was a villain and most of the time a hero, etc. So I felt what they had from the comics, I could see where they pulled the stuff to get where they got. And when they basically did a fake out of, oh, he's not really dead, that worked.
Yeah.
You know, and it got to the point where, yeah, it's dad.
But I think they could have sold that better. I think the tip off that it wasn't him, it was dad, was too subtle.
Yeah, I think they could have, well, I think they not only could have played that better, but then the way Yolanda basically takes out Brainwave didn't feel overly heroic. And there really hasn't been any kind of repercussions for that yet. Not agreed. That there was a lot of time.
Well, I wish there had been at least some comment along the lines of, didn't see that coming, did you? I've learned to act instinctively because of people like you. Kind yeah. of a, if my thoughts aren't safe, then I have to lash out.
Well, if an aspect of sometimes she acts on impulse and
yeah.
yeah, literally didn't think about it. I think one of the strengths and weaknesses of this show is the Stargirl show tried to do so much.
Mm.
Number of characters, number of plot lines. They developed all the characters.
Yeah.
They not only had the backstory of the original JSA as well as this current crop, they tossed in the Seven Soldiers of Victory, you know, at least through implication and backstory. We didn't see most of them, only two, three if you count Starman. And I'm curious if that's going to come back in some way, shape, or form next season. And I certainly don't want them to, like, pare down and streamline or anything, because I thought it was a very well-realized show. But there was points where there was just so much going on.
Well, there were characters that came, Artemis Croc.
Yeah.
And then got forgotten for quite a while. Cameron would come and go, come and go.
Yeah, they had more characters than they knew how to deal with, because you had seven members of the Injustice Society. For the most part, they all had a family. Now, granted, two were married, so it cuts a little, but, and Gambler didn't really have a family, but still.
Gambler came and went. Gambler was missing for like three episodes.
Yeah. And survived the season.
Yes. That's true. He snuck out.
So there's stuff they could do with him if they wanted to, but I don't feel they're obligated to bring him back.
Most of what they did on the hero's side was with the teenagers. Most of what they did on the villain's side was with the adults.
Well, I agree and disagree, because I think on both sides there were legacy aspects. It's just we focused on the parental side and should we give the legacy to the kids, whereas on the hero side, for the most part, the parents were out of the picture and the kids were taking the legacy.
But it was kind of a...
It was a generational gap, yeah.
Yeah. And there was some interaction between, like, Barbara and Jordan. So, between the generation up there. But, like, I always go back to One Tree Hill. That was a CW, WB show that did an amazing job of having very interesting plot things going on within the teenagers, within the adults,
yeah.
And then across the teenagers and the adults.
Well,
and I don't think this walked all of those balances.
I agree with that. At times, Smallville had the, here's what's going on with Clark, Lana, and Lex. Here's what's going on with their parents. And sometimes stuff would cross between. I mean, they covered the gambit a bit more. Here, we got Yolanda's parents.
Briefly.
We got Dr. Midnight's parents, briefly.
Beth's parents were there early on.
And then we've established them so they can go away.
Yeah. Well, it's more of a, now that Beth has friends, she doesn't need parents.
Exactly. We got Rick's parents in a backstory episode, because they're out of the picture current day.
Uh-huh. And then once we established that his guardian wasn't all that great, we no longer need to see him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, again, part of that, though, is just there's so many characters.
Well, once Pat and, to a degree, Barbara, started being the surrogate parents of the team,
mm-hmm.
once a team member got adopted in, they no longer needed their family.
Even the scene at the end with the Christmas party or whatnot, the kids are there and the parents aren't.
Yeah. Well, and Mike says, let's take the traditional Dugan family Christmas picture.
Yeah.
And it's the team with their parents.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting for a show called Stargirl to focus so much on the JSA new version. But even, really, the focus was almost more on the Injustice Society.
Yes.
And she was certainly the lead character.
Mm-hmm.
But just like there's Team Flash, Team Arrow, etc., this show had, again, just so many characters in it.
Well, if I were going to use this show as an example in a writing course for film or TV, I would show it in terms of... They did a brilliant job of the villains or the hero of their own story.
I would agree with that. And I think, surprisingly, given how many characters are in this, the characters, for the most part, all feel very realized.
Yes.
And that's not only counting the Dugan family, the new JSA, the Injustice Society and their supporting familial units, but it's also counting most of the old JSA. Because we get a surprising amount about the original Dr. Midnight through the glasses.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really get much about Green Lantern, Flash, Hawkman, Johnny Thunder, etc.
Or Wildcat. I'd say he's the one we get the least about.
We get some exposition. We never know the person.
Yeah.
But we at least know who the characters are.
Yes.
And we get some of that to a lesser degree with the Seven Soldiers of Victory. So if you were to basically go through and say, from a plot perspective, what characters are relevant,
yeah,
there's probably about 30, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for a 13-episode season.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm sure if we stopped and thought about it, we could come up with probably another half dozen or dozen.
But when you think about it, it does go back to something that was in the pilot, where they're walking down the main street of Blue Valley, Nebraska, and everybody's saying hi. And Mike's like, what's wrong with these people? What is going on?
Yeah.
And they're going, it's a small town community in Nebraska. People are friendly. People know each other.
It's a small town on the surface.
True. Okay.
It's gargantuan underneath.
Yes. Especially under the football field.
Yeah, I mean, the number of underground tunnels and layers and so forth is insane. I'm wondering if they take over the underground stuff.
That'd be interesting.
I also think there's an opportunity in next season or the one after to bring in characters like Jade or Obsidian or some of these other legacy types who've been elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
Have grown up, have mastered their powers, and maybe unknowns to this group,
mm-hmm.
but legit claim on the JSA title.
Yeah.
Kind of a competing team. So I think there's some potential there. Overall, I think it was well cast. It was well conceived.
It was well paced.
Yes. It never felt like, oh, geez, this is taking forever, or wow, they just blew through that.
Yeah.
And while there's an overarching plot for the season of the big brainwash everybody endeavor, the New America thing, every episode had its own feel to it.
Yeah.
And never felt like it was only in service of the bigger story.
Yeah.
So I was pleased with that.
It was surprisingly episodic for a streaming show.
Yes. Yes. A lot of streaming shows, like on Netflix and stuff, are like a book in the way they're told. Clearly chapters that are not meant to stand on their own.
Yeah.
Here, at the end of every episode, it felt like, again, not beginning, middle, and the end, but a beginning, middle, and end of its self-contained unit that fit into the bigger part.
At the end of every episode, it was a, if you need to pause watching here and come back tomorrow, we understand, it's okay, you won't fall off a cliff and die.
The one exception to that was the two-part finale, which I would expect.
Yeah.
Build up to it, and then, you know.
Yeah.
But even that paused at a good point. Whereas there are some other shows where they're telling one big story, not 13 smaller ones that build into a bigger one.
Yeah.
It may seem like a semantic difference, but it's not.
Well, and I know we've talked about it before, but there are some shows that at the end of every single episode, they leave you on the dangling off the edge of a cliff. But then there's Homeland that instead of opening the door with a dun-dun-dun, opens the door and shows you who's there, and you go, oh, wait. I need to rethink things. Thank you for giving me a week to do that, dearie.
Yeah. There are some shows that get to that cliffhanger of, oh, they're all in jeopardy. I must tune back to finish this story. And there are others that end on a reveal or a light bulb kind of a moment where it's like, oh.
Yeah.
Based on that, I need to rethink.
Yeah. Because I remember there was a Homeland episode where throughout the episode, we had been seeing basically a dead drop delivery of messages.
Mm-hmm.
And we were only seeing the hand of the person retrieving it. And then the final scene, we see the hand and then we see the face of the person reading it. And we're like, that's who's been reading these?
Yeah. You're thinking one thing up until that point. But now that you've got that reveal, you have to reassess
and
reprocess. That kind of needing time to digest it, I think, is good storytelling.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel any of these ended on, oh my God, that was that completely, you know, made me rethink everything I ever knew about these characters or whatever.
No.
But it ended on a clean note per episode.
I would also say that they did a really good job of good storytelling, but keeping it at that teen college level, if you will, to where, like, when Courtney's understanding of her universe is shattered.
And the actress did a great job in that episode.
And she really did. She conveyed the weight. I thought I knew it. They conveyed through the story, through the acting, through everything, the shattering of her self-confidence. And the fact that she had been really turning to Pat for so much up to that point. But when she's at the top of the stairs and she says, I need both of you, to Barbara as well as Pat, to her mom and her stepdad, to come with me and basically just stand there and help me build my self-confidence.
What I thought was a turning point for the character was when Courtney was outside with her dad and he's asking for the locket.
Yes.
And she gives it to him, and it seemed to me like the value of that locket went from priceless to worthless.
Yes.
As he was asking for it and acknowledging he was going to sell it for cash.
Yes.
And she knew that's why he came.
Yes. Yes.
And it wasn't that her self-worth went away, but her primary illusion of who her dad was, being Starman, had already been shattered. But this other illusion that, oh, he came back for me, of the real dad,
Yeah.
Was now gone.
Well, but then when she went inside and Pat said, if you need to yell at me,
yeah,
whatever you need, I'm here. And gave her the hug she asked for, basically, because she ran into his arms and embraced him. And, you know, he held her, he rubbed her back. And then when she was ready to go, is the presumed end of that scene, because we don't see it. But then he goes after the dad and says, I hope it was worth it.
Well, and I think they did a good job of building the relationship between Courtney and Pat throughout. But I also appreciated, while they didn't spend as much time on it, building a reciprocal one between Mike and
Barbara.
And Barbara.
Yeah. Oh, I loved after the science fair when the two of them are on the couch.
Eating the volcano.
Yeah, the candy village.
Yeah.
And he's like, nobody appreciates the taste of a melted candy village.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah. Mike at times got the short end of the script, but he was well used.
Yeah.
And again, I need to reread the Stars and Stripe series. I may see if I can get one of my co-hosts to do that as probably two back issue spotlights. And then at some point I may want to reread Infinity Inc. just to go back for the source material, because I really enjoyed Infinity Inc. back in the day. So it's cool that they've taken some, I'm going to go with off the beaten path characters, because for a while Earth 2 was really big and stuff, and then the characters got incorporated in the mainstream universe, JSA was big, whatever. But most people prior to the show would not have known who probably almost any of these characters were, if they were not a comic reader or whatnot. Or if they did know about them, it was from the few episodes they were in of Legends of Tomorrow or Smallville or something like that. But for them to basically create a new Earth, populate it with so many rich and wonderful characters, tell a very good story, and not feel to have really skimped on casting, on sets, on effects or writing or anything like that.
Well, and I think sets, in terms of both the underground amazing tunnel system, etc., but also we were half joking, half serious early on when we're like two episodes in and we're like, wherever they filmed this, they bought in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a mural on the side of one building that's Blue Valley Tires gets you where you need to go, and it's Blue Valley this and Blue Valley that, and it looked like they took over a town.
It would be interesting to find out where they filmed this and kind of how much the town bought into it, because it seemed like a good thing in terms of it was immersive.
From the closing credits, it looked like somewhere in Georgia, but probably. I could be wrong.
But, I mean, between the garage that Pat has, their house, the school, the American Dream or whatever building.
Yes. And, you know, the American Dream building with its clock tower that kind of looks like it doubles as a bell tower. It reminded me of so many small town city squares.
Mm-hmm. It captured that small town feeling.
Yes. Beautifully.
Other than the gargantuan city beneath it, you know, that was built without anyone noticing. The part that really got me was when they're putting the big satellite dish thing that pops out underneath the high school football field.
Mm.
And I'm like, okay, so the entire football field slides back to about the 12-yard lines.
On each side,
On each side. And there's like no supports over that whole area because, well, they've got to slide the whole thing out or whatever. And then as you're looking through down into there, it's like, okay, well, there's clearly just this cavernous area beneath that street back there, the bleachers over there, the stadium over there, all this kind of a stuff or what have you. It's well built. However, they hollowed out the earth underneath this town.
It was very James Bond, 20 stories of launch the missile from here type effect.
I appreciated the token line or two of how this was the city of the other founding fathers and it had underground things and stuff like that. To me, that covered, okay, that's where the meeting room is. That's where the Dragon King's, you know, science area is, whatever. The huge cavernous area under the football field that was literally, you know, 20 stories deep or something.
Yeah. Well, at one point, they're doing the pan out as, I think it was Brainwave, walks out to where he's going to sit. And I'm like, Okay, it looks like we're doing the Star Wars walk across the bridge with no railing. Oh, wait, we're getting to...
Cerebro.
Yes, the chair at the round...
To me, the whole thing had such an X-Men vibe on it. I mean, part of it is you've got this big cavernous thing with this long, you know, walkway out into nowhere with, and then this, you know, circular area with a chair.
Yeah.
It's like Professor X is going to go out there.
Yeah.
It was well done.
It was.
They sold what the place looked like. It didn't feel like cheesy TV effects.
The only time I got confused was when Brainwave came in from the chair through the doors to fight Yolanda. And then Yolanda and Stargirl went back through the doors. And instead of getting to the chair, they got to the base of where the satellite dishy thing was.
Well, and there was also the time where the walkway actually had rails.
That was the same time.
Okay. It at least looked cool.
It looked awesome. Yeah. Yes, it did.
So I think they did a good job on this. I'm curious how quickly it'll be able to get a second season out.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've started writing it, filming it, or anything of the sort. But I enjoyed this. I thought it was good. I kind of see it as part of the greater Arrowverse universe, if not the same literal universe, but a sister one to it. I would like to see them team up.
I think it'll fit well on CW.
It definitely has an in for a Flash crossover.
I was thinking it has that lighter, brighter Flash feel, especially with Courtney's very positive outlook on 99% of life.
Well, and also Barry Allen would be the old man in the group.
Yes.
They'd be calling him Sir and all this kind of a thing.
Yes.
And the way they had the banners and stuff in the images of the Jay Garrick Flash, they hadn't cast.
Yeah.
It could be the Wesley Allen Shipp version. It could be a different one.
Yeah.
It's got the classic helmet and stuff. So there's some fun stuff there. Also be fun with Supergirl and some of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see where they go if they eventually cross over. I'd like to be just one or two shows, not necessarily the full-blown thing, but we'll see what happens. Either way, I'm not terribly excited about the Eclipso tease. The other tease, curious where they're going, but they need to explain it, and I want to see where else they go.
They had three teases.
The one at the apartment complex.
Right. The one in the storage room and then down in the lair. The, I think it was a top hat. And...
Oh, right. That I do want to talk about. Thanks for reminding me. That's Shade, who's a member of the Injustice Society, had been in the photo the whole time, kind of hidden in the background. He has darkness powers.
Mm.
In the comics, he basically turned good. He's kind of immortal.
Oh, interesting.
And he was a friend of Jack Knight, the Starman whose staff this Courtney has, but not through that thing. So. He seems to have taken over the lair, and implication is he'll be there next time. I'm curious where they go with him.
So he's a bit of a wild card in terms of could be good, could be bad.
Yeah, I expect they'll play him as a good guy. Not a heroic go out and fight crime good guy, but a former bad guy on the side of the Angels. Not when he has to be.
Do you think he'll already be on the side of the Angels, or do you think this will be his redemption?
Could go either way. He's on the side of good in so much as he doesn't actively do evil. But again, he's not a crime fighter. He's not going to join the JSA. He's not that type. He's an advisor. He is the wisdom of the ages type, if you will.
Yeah.
Again, how they go with him could be very different. In the Starman series that Jack Knight started in for, I'm going to say, 80 issues or something. He was kind of that confidant that you'd go talk to once in a while. They would do kind of the times past, and you would see him through the ages and stuff like that. Picture an English gentleman all in black, darkness powers and stuff. And I would almost say he's on the side of good because he's kind of tired of being on the other side.
Yeah.
And the darkness in contrast to Courtney's lightness, visually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could be very interesting and could almost, I don't see, be a grandfatherly figure, but there's definitely some stuff they could do.
Interesting.
I, again, don't recall if he ever showed up in the Stars and Stripes comic series. Don't think he did, but again, don't remember. He was mainly, again, he goes all the way back to the 40s and stuff, but was mainly used in more recent eras in the Jack Knight Starman. Mm. And again, there's aspects of that they're pulling from, but only tangentially. The main touchstones for this series are Stars and Stripe, which established the Stargirl and this version of Stripesy and Stripe and the robot and all that kind of stuff. Definitely some aspects from Infinity Inc. Also a few things from the JSA series that Geoff Johns wrote. Nothing specific, but just kind of, again, it's Earth 2-ish type stuff. So, like I said, looking forward to a second season. Hopefully it comes along in short order. Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.